I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source with the Egyptian graffiti genius known as Ganzir. He's in our country now, and I'm presuming to welcome him as an artist of radical humanism. 4 years ago in Cairo, Ganzir was first among the young outlaws who painted the truth about Egypt's dictatorship and the promise of the Arab Spring on the walls of their city. They made images that beat guns. For a while, Ganzir hand-painted a famous highway billboard of a giant tank aiming at a bread delivery man on his bicycle. He made an iconic poster of Egyptian police with American guns stripping and beating up a lady protester in Tahrir Square. 4 years later, the same intrepid Ganzir, just into his 30s, has taken root in Brooklyn. He's got New York and the United States in his sights for an all-American Ganzir show of new paintings and posters. His impressions of us are merciless. Not exactly funny, not quite incendiary, but tough. Maybe just what we need from an artist and humanist of Egypt and the wide world. One Sunday afternoon this winter, Ganzir let me into his Brooklyn studio for a long gab about art as social commentary, about concept pop, as he calls it, which is to say, idea-driven art that comes with a sort of punch in the nose. We're talking about what he sees as the face of America, and I keep wondering, do we get the joke? Can we take it?
I just noticed things. I noticed that, I noticed that Robin Williams' death, for example, grabbed far more media attention in the papers and whatnot than the events in Ferguson, which were happening exactly at the same time. Media aside, just like normal day-to-day experiences, you see things. You know, you're on the subway and you hear for the first time this loudspeaker telling people that all of their bags are subject to random search by the police if the police feels like it, which is like a quality of an authoritarian state. It doesn't get more obvious than that, you know? You see cops harassing guys who are playing music on the subway if they're African-American. Of course, when you land in Williamsburg, and you know there's some like white hipsters playing music on the subway, the cops are standing there, but they're not doing anything about it. So you start to see trends, and you start to notice things that are just like so clear.
Things hidden in plain sight, as we say.
Right. For example, like nationalist propaganda, of course, and the U.S. style is something that is kind of new in the Egyptian context, with the display of the Egyptian flag in public space to a nauseating degree. Is something that's new and happened recently with the military takeover in Egypt. And so that, for example, is something that you could create a direct link easily for me, is like, oh, where this kind of enforced nationalism comes from and what motive it is intended on serving. Mm-hmm. But then you come to the United States and maybe it's this practice has been here for a longer time, but you see just like the flag on every single vehicle of public transportation. You know, you see it on the buses, on the subways, on every single car. It's like really trying to enforce this idea of American nationalism, right, in public space. You know, you see these incredibly pointless glossy magazines at every single newsstand to kind of control society in a particular direction, to sway them in a particular direction, to constantly be happy, to constantly have great sex, great American body, great American summer, great American dad, whatever it is. You know, it's just like ridiculous. I mean, it's just out there. It's so obvious everywhere.
It's all obvious unless you live here all the time.
Right.
What about the people?
I see a lot of immigrants. Mostly. People who are actually not American at all, not in any way American. So I think what's interesting about all this Americanism that's in the air is just like maybe trying to get people to assimilate and become American, even though they're so obviously not. Most people in New York are not really American.
Ganzir, I'd love you to teach us about graffiti as commentary and art as satire, commentary, maybe revelation. In Egypt, it just dawned on me like a new idea that graffiti more than cell phones was the real fire and the communication of that whole energy and spirit around the world. And we forget that. We forget the power of distilled, almost postage stamp simplicity of an image.
We are a visual people. We have this long history of a visual culture. You know, if you want to take it back to ancient times, it's there. If you want to, even in modern times, the notion of the image itself is something that I think is a big part of Egyptian culture. You know, you could have long discussions about a point and debates. It could just like go on forever and not lead to anything really. There's something about an image that, you know, just draws a point in a very kind of direct, very clear, very straightforward, just like nailing it, like bringing it home, you know. Mm. With an image, I feel even if you disagree with it, it just leaves an impression on your brain anyway. It's there.
Right.
And plants a seed, whether you like it or not.
This is why Stalin and Hitler were so deathly afraid of caricaturists and image makers.
Right.
Even more than of writers, much more.
Right. Especially ridicule, right? Because when you put someone who wants to be a very powerful person, a force to be reckoned with, right? And then once you put that person on the path of ridicule, there's no taking the joke away, and then it leads to more ridicule and so on. And I feel like satire in particular is more powerful than any weapon, because honestly, long after this person is dead, if the joke is good enough, they're going to remember the joke. They're not going to remember anything else. And, you know, Egyptians kind of also have a reputation for liking to laugh. They do enjoy satire and ridicule.
It fascinates me that your work in this country and your exhibition is really sort of taking on a new role. I mean, it's adding something quite different to American commentary. I worry mainly whether we can take it.
Right.
We love to think of ourselves as irreverent people, and we embrace Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert with admiration and love and awe when they're very, very funny. And yet you come at it with a real sledgehammer. Can we look at a poster, NYPD, kill people, 212, kill people, and say, there's a certain kind of crazy truth there that we ought to consider now and then?
You know, I guess I'm going to find out. We're all going to find out. I don't necessarily be interested in tackling an American president, because I feel the American president doesn't really have much power after all and doesn't really change anything much, right? And there's other things that are more sacred things. The American president is not a sacred person. He comes, he goes. You know, there's nothing sacred about him. American history is sacred. The American flag is sacred, right? People pledge allegiance to the American flag. They don't pledge allegiance to the American president.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the things that must be tackled.
Let's talk about some of these images in the show itself, including your new money.
Yes. So this is called Honest Money, and it's a series of six redesigned bills. So we have the $1, the $5, $10, $20, $50, and $100. And each of these bills, rather than celebrating some kind of historical figure or political figure, it highlights an actual incident in American history. So if we look at the $1, the $1 has a hand holding a severed head of Native American man. This is, of course, exemplifies what I would argue as the first major event in American history, which is the genocide of the Native American population.
And no then, Thanksgiving on your bills.
Right, no Thanksgiving on my bills. The rear side shows where there are Native American reservations today. These Native American reservations tend to be seen as the American way of doing good by these people. You know, they have their reservations and you're sorry and whatever, so it's fine. However, these reservations occupy about 2.3% of the entire country. So an incredibly small percentage. To be honest, looking at this map, the only thing it brings to mind is Israel and Palestine. So you have like some scattered bits of Palestinian land, right? But then the fact of the matter is the entirety of the land is occupied land and taken from these people. And then we on the $5 bill, we have the enslavement of the African population, bringing them on board of ships and taking them to the Americas to serve European settlers. And on the rear shows the number of Americans currently in prison, the percentage of Africans in those prisons, African-Americans in those prisons today, as well as the percentage of white, Hispanic, and Native Americans in those prisons. The $10 bill shows the exploitation of the Chinese workers in building the American Railroad. On the rear, we see sort of a map of the U.S. Transcontinental Railway, circa 1887. So you can create a direct link between the connection of this large, large, large continent, this large mass of land, and who was actually responsible for it, these Chinese workers. And in 1882, U.S. Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. And that was the reward for being in America and building the railway. On the $20 bill, we have an illustration of some extinct animals. In particular, this is an illustration of the California golden bear, the eastern cougar, and the Carolina parakeet. And on the rear, we have an infographic that shows the percentage of North American animals that have gone extinct since the arrival of the European settler. That percentage is 10%. Not an insignificant number of animals that have perished as a result of the European settler. We also have the $50 bill that shows U.S. troops arriving in Kuwait circa 1990. And on the rear, we have where there are U.S. military bases around the world. About 76.6% of countries on the planet host U.S. military bases. It's about 2.5 million U.S. military personnel, 737 military bases in over 150 countries. And finally, on the $100 bill, we have an illustration that shows some ancient artifacts housed in U.S. museums. And we took one particular U.S. museum, which I found some information on. And that museum was the Met. 39.5% of those artifacts come from Egypt, India, Greece, the Roman Empire, Peru, Syria, Turkey, Korea, Africa, and Asia. The Met makes an annual revenue of approximately 68 to 70 million U.S. dollars. That's one museum in the U.S. 0% of that money goes to Egypt, India, Turkey, Italy, Peru, Syria, Turkey, Korea, Asia, or Africa. Meanwhile, the Disney Consumer Products Company made $39.3 billion in the year 2013 off of licensing the usage of Disney characters in foreign countries on consumer goods.
Gensai, everything about this is interesting. First, the idea of a foreigner delivering this stuff sort of in your face, America. It's funny, it's tough, it's true, it's not the whole truth, but it's very unfamiliar. It's Orientalism turned 180 degrees. Look what they do in the West.
I'm not sure what to label. I'm just saying it like it is. That's all I'm doing.
Another fascinating thing to me is that it comes as art.
But you have a certain kind of activist-y art. It's not going to change anybody's mind, pumped up fist with like a slogan and like resist or something. It's just like it speaks to someone who already has certain inclinations anyway, as opposed to bring light to someone who was never interested before, right? Not so enlightening necessarily. So it fails, I think, on two levels, whether it's the conceptual aspect or whether it's the aesthetic aspect. And then, of course, if we look at what's happening in the contemporary art sphere, so there's a lot of art that is not really about anything in particular. It just entirely focuses on aesthetic experiments and playing with materials. I kind of call it art for supervillains. If you think about your standard Hollywood villain figure, and you think about that person and what his house would look like if there would be art in it, it's probably going to be some of the art that you might possibly find in a Chelsea gallery. And then, of course, you have like street art or graffiti, right? So graffiti, there's a lot of tagging, people writing their names on walls, which is pointless as well. Or people who do murals and draw these very beautiful things that they can do with spray paint. And they're big, they're very large, and they're impressive, technically speaking, but then they're not really about anything as well, right? So these are the major movements in the art sphere here, and it is a little disappointing, disheartening that there isn't enough art that can experiment with a method or something. It should actually be about something in the process of doing that, right?
How would you cast yourself? What do you call your alternative?
I call it concept pop. And for me, it's just a way of doing art that can use these pop references, popular symbols, popular forms, but rather than do it for no reason, do it with an actual concept behind it. But of course, in so doing, it's also very different from conceptual art, which often tends to deliver concepts in a very bland, unaestheticized way, right? I feel like it's an approach that kind of occupies this particular mid-ground that I try to kind of dance in a little bit.
You remind me in a way of Ai Weiwei, who is always berating his fellow artists in China to speak to the social reality, speak to tradition, speak to what's actually going on right now. And of course, it's much harder in his society, but it's not much done in this country. in the United States.
No, it's not. And then that's kind of the irony of the United States. The United States will take people like Ai Weiwei and put them on a pedestal. And there are political motivations behind doing so. China in particular is a country that the U.S. takes some issue with. And for there to be someone standing up to that is someone that the U.S. will celebrate in mass media very much without artists in the U.S. thinking of doing the same in their own country at all. And also, I mean, to criticize Ai Weiwei, you know, when he shows art here, he also shows art that is relates to the Chinese context, but he also seems to be incapable or unaware or naive enough to not really do anything also about the context here, which is something that, of course, I could have very easily fallen into myself and was, in fact, asked to fall into and asked to perform that role, becoming this avatar of some kind of resistance movement in some other country, right? But of course, it's a role that I completely refuse. But almost every single profile or review always tends to focus on the Egyptian aspect of my work. Mm. A lot of artists fall into that trap, right?
Is that the Orientalist temptation that you're drawn into automatically in this country to underscore the strangeness of the world you come from?
I mean, whether it's the artist's own inclination to do that sort of thing or whether it's generally encouraged by the press or the curatorial gallery spheres or whatever, is questionable. Maybe it's a combination of both, right? But it is something very easy to fall into as an artist coming from this very interesting exotic land, right? It's not necessarily a problem a lot of Western artists face necessarily when they go do work in other countries.
I met Ai Weiwei in China last June, and he talked about this country and living here for 10 years, but he said something like, well, a country can't be all bad that would produce Edward Snowden, who is, of course, a government operative in a way and a truth teller.
And who is on the run from the government.
Exactly, and I couldn't get over it, really. There's dissident.
But then you could say the same thing about China. You could say, well, a country isn't so bad that produced someone like Ai Weiwei.
That's exactly what I said to him.
Okay.
But the funny part of it was to realize he is sitting there in his capital at the center of a huge art colony. He's a big celebrity. He's a famous man. He's the kind of second government and very popular in a way. And poor Snowden is in exile in Moscow. Let's talk about this image we're sitting in front of all this time. Great rose-colored canvas. It must be, what, 10 feet, 12 feet wide, with a figure of an African man, ambiguously a child or maybe Barack Obama, holding a giant machine gun. And the inscription in German is, Ist die Wahrheit konkret? This is the real hard truth.
So this was a collaboration with two other street artists in Frankfurt, 2012. It was displayed in public on the street. You see holes there. It was kind of tied to a fence. Something essential in the significance of the piece is sort of missing. So here we have an outline of a gun. We have the child. He's holding what looks like an outline of a machine gun, right? The machine gun itself is not actually there, but we could see the outline of it.
Mm.
What filled the outline initially as this work was displayed on the street in Frankfurt was euro bills. The machine gun was made out of euro bills.
Mm.
And as you could see here, all the euro bills are missing. So the piece received its share of, I guess I would say, citizen censorship.
Who stripped the euro bills?
People walking down in front of the piece.
Ah.
On the street. Which is the same kind of censorship a lot of my work in my own country has received. Things have been sprayed over and censored to cover it up, or torn off the walls, or so on. So rather than having a machine gun made out of European money, just looks like another kid from Africa holding a machine gun, right? Which, of course, obliterates what the piece is about, which is essentially the financial interests of Europe in supplying guns to these child soldiers in Africa.
Does it or doesn't it look a little like Barack Obama? They're holding the weapon.
Well, that was not my intention.
I think you've given yourself an incredibly interesting role in the home of the brave, the land of the free. This is jarring, but we're overdue for it.
I don't think I'm necessarily saying anything that no one said before. That would be crazy to think so. I'm sure it's been said, maybe not necessarily in this particular way or using this particular media, but it's out there for those who want to find it, you know.
Yeah. As we say in radio all the time, what's your definition of victory? What do you want to do?
You know, I just hope to continue to be able to make art that will hopefully be relevant. This Greek philosopher, Pliny the Elder, right? So Pliny the Elder.
Roman historian
and philosopher. He wrote, "True glory exists in doing what deserves to be written and writing what deserves to be read." Mm. So putting to paper something that deserves to be read in the first place.
Can you imagine staying here for the duration?
Oh, of course not. That would be ridiculous.
Have you been to China, for example?
No, I haven't. I would love to go.
Speak about Egypt. Is the Sisi turn forever, do you think?
No, I highly doubt it. I mean, we were talking about how bringing down a leader or dictator or someone who is power hungry in some way, it usually starts by just placing them on the path of ridicule, which has already started in Egypt.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't think there's much turning back there.
And with what sort of resolution? What sort of stability in the end?
I mean, the military's involvement will have to be crucial anyway, because they are the guys with the guns, you know, and American-sponsored guns, of course.
I think Americans to this day, Genzir, have almost no understanding of what the U.S. role was in Mubarak's reign, in Mubarak's downfall, in Morsi, in Sisi. What's the Egyptian common sense on this subject?
I mean, people know, they could see these weapons used firsthand, just the tear gas canisters made in Pennsylvania. I'm sure people in Pennsylvania don't know that they have a factory. If we want to say, oh, so what's changed in Egypt since, you know, the revolution, right? The one actually, like, a very obvious change you could see is that the police force in Egypt has become incredibly heavily militarized now. And of course, these weapons come from the Egyptian military, and the Egyptian military gets its weapons from the United States of America. So of course, the United States has a direct involvement in the killing of Egyptian people on the streets of Cairo today. And people in the United States do not know that. And the fact that they do not know that exemplifies the kind of democracy that they actually have. How is it that these people think that they live in a country where they do control the government's actions? Don't even know that the government is supplying weapons to kill people across the world. When Sisi's men themselves no longer want to support him and protect him and see his reign through, then we could possibly bring him down. And I think that can be done with art. You know, if there's enough art produced on this matter to make this part of the Egyptian rhetoric, to make this part of the discussion, to make this popular.
You have such a wonderful conviction about art, that art makes changes.
You just need a lot of it, that's all. You need a certain threshold for it to have that powerful effect on such a large group of people.
W.H. Auden said, poetry changes nothing. Is art different inherently? Do we want to aspire to that kind of activist art in this country?
Why label it as activist art? Art is either plagiarism or revolution.
If it's not forward, it's backward.
Right. But yeah, this is about pushing things forward. It's not about activism. It's about going beyond where we are today, which is necessary as human beings, as societies.
And the context is human. It's not Egyptian. It's not even American.
It has nothing to do with a nationality. It has nothing to do with a passport. It has to do with being a human being and being subject to injustice.
You've been very, very generous with your time and your views and your work. Thank you very, very much, Genzir, in Gowanus, in Brooklyn.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Our conversation at Genzir's studio in Gowanus, Brooklyn, was recorded by Kunal Jasti with help from Miranda Arakelian. You can see and explore all the artwork we talked about on our website, radioopensource.org. You can see more of Genzir's work at the Leila Heller Gallery on 25th Street at 10th Avenue in Manhattan. And get the news on Twitter at Genzir, G-A-N-Z-E-E-R, or on his website, genzir.com. Mary McGrath runs our production team of Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.